Wizardry by Consent by Sith Light. Chapter 3. Respect and Cooperation. Abdul calls the next morning, when Thomas is still unsure if he's in a good mood or not, to say he's got a match on the DNA from Mal and Breeden's assailant. "Two matches, actually," he says. "But one of them is to a Jarvan tiger, which isn't very useful. Unless you wanted to track down whoever created the Chimera, which is almost certainly unnecessary because it was our faceless friend," Thomas sighs. Sometimes he regrets the outcome of that particular fight. Sometimes. "What about the other?" "The other is to a criminal record, which Thomas has Annie hunt down and print out for him. Jacob Miller, now in his mid-30s, born in Birmingham, notably only, if you can call him notable at all, for a string of arrests in his late teens and early 20s. Petty stuff for the most part, small-time burglaries and disturbing the peace. The photograph is of a perfectly ordinary young man, brown hair and brown eyes, a sullen expression and an unfortunate set of ears. The important thing for their purposes is that Miller drops off the radar entirely between 20 and 15 years ago. No arrests, no convictions, nothing else either when Annie finishes running the rest of the searches. No NHS records, no welfare applications, no births or marriages or even a death certificate. Nothing. But then, Thomas considers, the difficulties of interacting with bureaucracy are somewhat increased when you look like a tiger. He shows the photograph to Mal, who is propped up on an armchair in the reading room doing Latin exercises diligently. Thomas can't fault her work ethic. She says, "Nope, sorry, no resemblance, but with the fur and the ears and the fangs and everything, it'd be hard to tell, you know." "All tiger people look the same," suggests Matthew innocently from one armchair over. Mal narrows her eyes at him for a split second, then laughs. "Basically, I reckon." "Can I see, sir?" asks Abigail, coming into the room. "Huh, doesn't look that interesting. Wonder what made him volunteer." "He may not have," Thomas says, "given the person we believe affected his transformation." "Do you think he was a furry?" Mal wonders aloud. Matthew goggles at her in horror and tries to hide behind Pliny. Thomas looks over just in time to see Abigail make frantic cut-it-off motions with her hands. "I don't think his sexual fetishes are likely to be of particular relevance to the case at hand," he says, "because clearly they all assume he has no idea what the term means, or at least they don't want to know if he does." There's a peculiar choking noise from the doorway. It is, of course, Annie. Do I want context for this conversation?" she asks. "No," says Matthew. "You're right, sir. Not relevant," Mal says to Thomas. She's too dark to blush, which is probably lucky for her right now. "Sorry." "We were trying to figure out why someone would volunteer to get made into a tiger," Abigail tells Annie prosaically.
Oh,
Annie says, and Thomas wonders what the world is coming to, but only in a very vague way. Matthew is still rather red, poor lad. "This is great, though," Abigail goes on. "A name means we can find his family and associates, and that means we can find out how he's thinking, and that means we might actually find him." "Since you're so excited about the prospect, please feel free to start." Thomas hands her the folder. Abigail doesn't find anything quickly. Miller's recorded friends and family haven't seen him for years. Most say they assumed he was dead. Some petty crime gone wrong and body not identified. Of course, given what's happened to him, he might as well be, Thomas thinks. Likely, if he'd wanted to speak to his family in the intervening years, he would have. The interviews with Breeden's friend and family, and the quieter, slow work with the rest of the little crocodiles, hasn't provided anything either. Apparently, he was thinking of starting some new consultancy business with another Oxford friend, but that one is conveniently out of the country, a business trip to the United States. He's not on Thomas's list, but he was at Oxford at the right time. All they can do is wait until he gets back. Thomas can't justify sending one of the apprentices over with the possibilities at hand, and certainly can't go himself. Mal has started her recovery properly, doing her exercises with a determination that concerns Thomas slightly. Apparently, physical disability sits poorly with her, but he's saved from having to say anything, not knowing quite how to start, by Molly. Molly takes the simple expedient of either taking Mal's exercise equipment away from her or standing behind her staring silently until Mal gives up. She's quite taken to the concept of having other people in the folly, Thomas thinks. He wasn't sure she would. Wednesday starts out unpromisingly when Matthew smashes a mug in practice with a poorly aimed impello. The apple he was attempting to move going nowhere. What was that even doing here? Annie asks as she kneels to pick up the pieces. Ah! I left it in here yesterday, Abigail says. Sorry, you okay? No, I'm just screaming for the fun of it, Annie snaps. It turns out to not be a serious cut, but then Mal tries to help too fast and has to catch herself on a bench when her leg buckles, snaps herself at Matthew when he tries to help her. Thomas corrals the broken mug with magic and reminds them that they shouldn't really be mixing food and drink with laboratory space in best practice. David had told him that so many times, years ago, and cluttered his own lab with empty cups all the same. By the time he's done that, Abigail's ears are red and her mouth tight. Mal is wincing because she's pulled at her stitches. Annie is sucking her finger and glowering at Matthew as he pulls out the first aid kit, and Thomas is trying to remember why he ever thought apprentices were a good idea. Of course he didn't. It was Grant's idea. Thinking of Grant only leads to a certain amount of frustration, which doesn't improve Thomas's temper. He doesn't miss the years when he didn't have to get out of bed if he couldn't face the world, but by God, this is the sort of morning that would only be improved by returning to it. Molly appears at the lab door. A phone call, it must be. Tidy this up and keep going, all of you, Thomas tells them. It won't be a moment. This turns out to be a lie, though not an intentional one. He's being called in to a meeting with DPS immediately. He spends the entire trip tapping his fingers on the steering wheel and trying not to anticipate the reason. It never helps. They're questioning, he is told when he gets there, whether he should be involved with this case at all. What? Thomas says in sheer disbelief. Excuse me. Could you please explain the rationale for this? What conflict of interest am I supposed to have? Your unit has been focusing on the victim, not the murderer. We're working on the suspect's connections now. We have an identity, and there may be a link between them we've yet to conclusively identify. Breeden turns out to have been involved with a group. Ah, yes, the little crocodiles, says the DPS officer. He's maybe a decade older than Thomas's apparent age, solid-looking, not memorable. Good at his job, probably. Thomas hasn't encountered him before, but then DPS so rarely has cause to intersect with his cases, apart from, well, a group of rogue magicians? That's overstating the case, Thomas says. At least one very dangerous rogue magician, yes. The rest, I could never confirm that any of them had practiced magic beyond their association with Wheatcroft at Oxford, but certainly many had ties to Sutton, Lewis, Vile, and so on. Lewis in particular had been volubly cooperative, once identified. Only a pity that he'd never worked out what it was his friend, if friend was the word, had wanted with Sky Garden. A lack of imagination there. But it's not illegal, is it? Persisted the DPS officer, doing what they're doing. In the strictest sense, no, but it is dangerous, principally to the user, and in some cases. Are you familiar with what we found in that club in Soho? The officer looks a little green, meaning the answer is yes. Familiar enough. We're getting off track, though, Thomas. Using his name is probably supposed to put him at ease, but it sets Thomas's back up. Courtesies are such a strange thing, so hard to unlearn. You spent a lot of time looking into the victim and his associates in this case. There doesn't seem to be a lot of interest in catching the perpetrator. This is so far outside what Thomas was expecting that he stares for a moment. I assure you, he says when he finds his voice, we have a dead body and a perpetrator who runs the risk of raising some very difficult questions about things it's my job to keep out of the public eye. I and my unit have every interest in finding and arresting him. You've accounted him before, though, haven't you? It's possible. There was a chimera present at the Berwick Street incident, but I didn't get a good look at him, and we don't have good CCTV footage of the one we're looking for. The descriptions are broadly similar. We know there were more than one, but we've never identified any of them. So he could be an eyewitness to Berwick Street. Thomas opens his mouth, closes it, has to think. Again, it's possible. I wasn't aware of any eyewitnesses, any who survived, at the time, but my attention was rather focused on the faceless magician, on the women he'd held hostage wasn't even the right term, was it? tried to hold hostage, maybe. And the victim, the DPS officer goes on, was connected to the man you killed at Berwick Street, part of a group you still clearly regard as dangerous. I'm really not sure, Thomas says coldly, what you're suggesting. Either I want to eliminate an eyewitness to my possible misdemeanor, or I don't care about catching him because I'm prejudiced against the victim. Pick one. You can't have both. You aren't objective about this, he's told. You can't be. This isn't a case of another, what you call them, practitioner, someone you're the only person capable of taking in. It doesn't matter which of those things is true, if either are. It matters that it could be, and it matters that we're getting pressure to do this right. You have other staff in your unit now, kids who were still in primary school 15 years ago. They can liaise with the murder squad. We're recommending you sit this one out. If there is another magician involved in this, Thomas warns, it could get very messy very quickly. I have apprentices, but they're not ready for that. Not by a long shot. If that happens, you're not going to be in Antarctica. But until then, we're asking you to step aside. The commissioner has signed off on it. Thomas asks to see the paperwork and is shown it. It's a matter of record. The wording doesn't tell him anything. The next step up from appeal to the commissioner is the Home Secretary. And this isn't at all the sort of emergency that would justify that. Just every sense of danger Thomas has telling him there's something wrong here. Tyburn. It's got to be Tyburn. He didn't think she had this much pull. Will DCI May be continuing as SIO? He asks, handing the tablet back. Yes, says the officer. Your constables will work under her. Thomas wonders what he can do, and the answer is, for the moment, nothing. There's nothing he can do. He goes back to the folly. The first person he finds is Molly. Of course, he has to tell her right away. She claps her hands to her mouth in horror. Thomas feels himself lift his own hands reassuringly. If they were different people, he might touch her, but they're not different people. It's all right. It's all right. I'm going to get it sorted out. Molly gathers herself, nods, but her hands are still clenched in fists as she glides away. After a second, Thomas hears the faint thud of the rear door. Is she going out to the coach house? He wonders why. Telling the apprentices is worse. Annie is out. Word from Beverly Brook, Mal tells him. Matthew is working patiently through CCTV footage. Abigail is going over her interview notes again. Thomas found Mal in the mundane library, swearing at Pliny the Younger under her breath, which is a reasonable reaction by anybody's standards, even if Thomas pretends not to hear the language she uses. He can't when he tells her. She says, "Fuck, sir, are you kidding me?" "No, Mal, I'm afraid not." He tries to keep his voice gentle rather than curt. He's afraid he fails. "But that's not fair," she says, then gathers herself. "They don't have to be fair. Bother it. What do you need us to do?" Thomas reminds her she's still on medical leave and tells her to confine her more colourful language to Pliny, which at least gets a smile. Matthew just blinks up at him in confusion, says, "Really? But sir, really?" and then asks the same question. Abigail stands up, folds her arms, takes a few paces back and forth. "Tyburn," she says abruptly. "Sir, was it?" "It's the likeliest theory," Thomas allows. "In the meantime, you've done the bulk of the interview work, so get yourself over to Belgravia and see what DCI May wants you to do. You can't talk to me about it." She's already grabbing up her laptop on it, and she gives him a direct stare. "You know none of us believe you're not being fair about this case, right, boss? Whatever happened years ago." "I know," says Thomas, "because he does. Thank you." Abigail gives him the uneasy smile of someone who has outpaced her emotional capacity and flees. He calls Annie and gets her voicemail, tells her to meet Abigail at Belgravia. Then he looks around the lobby and, satisfied he's alone, sinks into a chair, head in hands. "God, is it that bad?" He looks up and, of all people, it's Grant. "What the hell are you doing here?" comes out before he can think about it. The apprentice's casual cursing is rubbing off on him. It's the first time they've seen each other face to face since they went for dinner. It feels like forever. It's maybe been a week. "I'm not here," Grant says. He's a little out of breath. "I'm getting lunch for myself because I wanted to walk. I did not get a taxi to drop me off two streets away, and I don't have 20 minutes before I have to head back. Did Tyburn seriously manage to get you taken off the case?" "Yes, and But then how are you going to have lunch? Thomas says, fixating on perhaps the least important part of that entire statement. Sod lunch. I had a proper breakfast. Grant folds his arms and continues to loom down at him. Well, Inspector? I didn't ask her to do it, assuming it was her. Thomas stands. It's a delaying tactic at best, and there's no point delaying unless she thinks she can accomplish something in the meantime. And what that? But with all due respect, how is this any of your business? Grant nods like he's accomplished something. Thomas can't imagine what. In that case, we're just going to have to make sure the case gets solved as soon as possible. My business, because I bullied you into taking apprentices, and now they're an excuse to take you off this. Also, Thomas perseveres, how did you know, unless it's already got around New Scotland Yard? Molly, obviously, says Grant. She really shouldn't have done that. Thomas hesitates, but he hasn't eaten lunch either, and it's nearly two. Follow me. Most weekdays now, Molly leaves out the makings of sandwiches on the main kitchen table. It doesn't keep everybody to a strict schedule. She isn't in the kitchen herself. Thomas is quite glad of it. He's not terribly happy with her. Help yourself, Thomas tells Grant and starts putting together his own meal. I was 50% sure you'd just throw me out, Grant says and follows suit. Sorry. Ask me politely to leave your nick. Look, what I came to say is, how can I help with this? There's got to be something. Whose decision was it? Your friend May is being given control of the case, Thomas says, hesitating over cheese and ignoring the direct question. He doesn't want to start playing that sort of politics, at least not through Grant. I can't ask you to carry information, but you might as well, seeing as I'm here, says Grant blithely. I'm surprised Leslie's still on. But then I guess pushing you off is as far as Tyburn can get. It's not like Leslie likes you. She needs to look harder into the victim and his associates, Thomas says. The question isn't who, it's why. And that might be answerable even without our culprit. They pull out chairs and sit at the table to eat. Leslie's not going to be impressed by that, says Grant. She's the old-fashioned sort of copper. Likes to have somebody to walk up the steps, you know. Preferably the guilty party, or at least a guilty party. DCI May has never struck me as being quite so indiscriminating. No, you're right, she's not. That was what I like to call sarcasm, but I hear it was only invented in 1985, so you might have missed it. Thomas can't help it, huffs a laughing breath at the same time as he tries to take a bite of sandwich. 1985, you say? My first inspector used to tell me that when he was a constable, he'd never even thought about being sarcastic in front of a senior officer, so I figure it can't have been around yet. They both eat in silence for a minute or two. I don't have anything else, Thomas says, changing the topic back to what matters. 20 minutes, Grant had said. I don't know what taking me off the case is going to do. They're worried upstairs, says Grant, who by any measure is upstairs. I read the file. You burned a lot of bridges 15 years ago. That's why they wouldn't let you take on an apprentice afterwards. Did they tell you that? Not in so many words, says Thomas, feeling weary, but he'd known. But I knew. Anyway, the thing is, even if it's specious, it's not going to go away any time soon, Grant says. I can't help you with that. I can help you with the case, maybe. With the apprentices? That's my chief concern, Thomas admits. Mal is on medical leave. She's out of things for a while. The other three, they could be put under pressure too. He cuts off as footsteps sound on the stairs. Too heavy for Abigail, too regular for Mal. It must be Matthew, and so it is. Matthew stops when he sees them. Crooks his head in confusion and then straightens up from his slight slouch. Commander Grant? Sir. I'm not here, Grant tells him. Possibly your gov is having an unusual hallucinatory episode, which would explain why he's talking to himself. That's all right, sir, Matthew says after a pause. We spend a lot of time talking to people who aren't really there in this unit. For Matthew, that's almost cheeky. Luckily for him, he's got the right audience. Grant chuckles. So I hear. He looks at his watch. Bugger, I've got to get going. PC Blake can give you a lift, Thomas offers. Grant just looks at him, but does not point out the lack of subtlety inherent in this offer in front of Matthew, charitable of him, or at least the fellowship of senior officers. Thanks all the same, I'll manage. Let me know if you think of... He trails off. If there's anything else. Sir, Thomas says, and Grant leaves with a nod to Matthew. Probably for the best Matthew came in, otherwise Thomas might have been tempted to... might have been... He really needs to set it aside, what happened the other night. They said maybe later, but with this, it's not a good idea. He knows that. Grant knows that. It's been so long since he wanted something like this for himself, though. It would have been nice if it was something he could reasonably have. I can't believe you managed to fuck somebody off this badly, says Leslie May. You! You get a direct line to the commissioner and everything. What did you do? She sounds genuinely bewildered, and it's not that she's not capable of misdirection, but Thomas believes her. He's fairly certain if she did know the details about Berwick Street or any of that, he'd have heard something from her about it in the last 15 years. Her disapproval has never been subtle, nor silent once she achieves sufficient rank to get away with voicing it. I'm sure it will be sorted out soon enough, he says. In the meantime, I trust you'll liaise with my junior officers. I have every confidence you'll close the case quickly. Thanks, Thomas. I was just waiting for your stamp of approval. It's not quite as sarcastic as it could be, though. You know I'm going to have to keep you totally out of the loop, right? I suppose you can keep working on whatever other weird you've got going. Don't tell me. I don't want to know. But this wall of silence. Technically, we're not even supposed to be having this conversation. Yes, he says. It would be better if Annie and Abigail weren't based here, for appearance's sake. Could you find them office space at Belgravia while they're working the case? She doesn't seem to have expected that. Starts slightly, but nods. I can do that. You haven't had that much time with them. They're still tolerable. Sarah's a bit unhappy you swiped Abigail, mind you. Wouldn't go expecting any favours from her any time soon. I wasn't anyway. Sarah Galeed came up through Belgravia as well, though she'd transferred later. In any case, they rarely needed help from fraud. I just hope you're working on this, May goes on. You know Peter will go for back for you where he can, right? It might help more than you think. Everybody likes Peter. Except when they take a violent dislike to him, but that's mostly the idiots anyway. It's being addressed, Thomas says carefully. He knows Grant wants to help, is not sure it will be helpful. The best thing to do now is to solve the case, find Miller. Getting him into custody is likely to make most of the problem go away, if he understands the case against him correctly anyway. That is, if you're inclined to be helpful. I'm inclined to do my sodding job, says May. Whether it helps you or not is beside the point. Someone's dead and I want someone to arrest for it, the guilty party for preference. Thank you, says Thomas. She glowers at him. It's harder than he thought it would be, being walled off like this from a case his apprentices are all still working. Conversations cease when he walks into the room. There are unaccustomed silences at dinner when somebody goes to ask a question and then thinks better of it. Fortunately, they're also all entering the exciting new territory of a new former, as well as Tacitus. Everybody except for Annie, who is far enough ahead, he's got her to start on Greek as well. As well as all the usual small bits and bobs the rest of the match tosses their way. So there's other things to discuss. It isn't that he doesn't trust Leslie May, but he's really not minded to sit this one out any longer than he has to. So he's suggested, indirectly, that Abigail and Annie should make sure they follow up every contact they have. Miller has been around for years somewhere. Somebody knows where and why, and where he might have gone. They won't talk to him, even if he was still on the case. The apprentices, there's a chance. He's not entirely shut off, either. This is his home, after all. So it doesn't really qualify as eavesdropping if he overhears things. By anybody's standards, surely. What did Inspector Kumar say? Abigail is asking Annie. That he'll have to check the Crossrail plans, and they got filed away years ago. If the originals are even still there, says Annie. He seems awfully suspicious, I have to say. That's because he's smart, Abigail grouses. Look at the kind of people we're dealing with. It would be interesting to have a real cover-up, Annie says thoughtfully. Never had one of those. You mean like our entire job right now? It's not the same, though. We're not covering anything up most of the time. We're just not reporting extraneous details. That's accurate enough. Thomas disapproves of cover-ups on the whole. They get messy very quickly. So much easier to just not tell people things they don't need to know. The charade-like nature of the entire thing is revealed in its entirety when Thomas gets called in as soon as they actually find something. May makes the call, but she hastens to inform him she's not the one who okayed it. DPS gave in, she says. After the third, I don't know, from your constables, I had to do something. And it got pushed up the chain to the assistant commissioner and then back down. Is Miller in custody? Thomas asks. Yeah, but you're not allowed anywhere near him. They haven't gone that soft. It's where we found him that we need you for. It's a bit of a mess. Don't wear your good clothes. Thomas wears his white Burberry, which is prone to showing every stain. Firstly, because he's never encountered a stain yet Molly can't take care of. Secondly, because he's going to have to put on one of those ridiculous disposable forensic suits anyway if it's an actual crime scene. And thirdly, because it will annoy May intensely. It used to have just the same effect on her mentor. It's probably not within the spirit of things, but he sends Matt to go find out where Miller is and what they're doing with him. "You can't tell me about it, I think," he says, "but it would be helpful for you to know." "I could," Mel tries, and Thomas cuts her off. "You're still on medical leave, and you got injured trying to arrest him." Mal scowls, but lets it go. Matt says, "Anything you want me to pass on?" Mal sighs. "Nah, no fun swearing at people secondhand." The thing they've found that requires his presence is some sort of underground space, constructed during Crossrail and marked as an emergency exit on the plans. Jagat Kumar identified it, and Miller turned out to have been hiding in it. There's all the usual debris of squatting, combined with a very strong and musky smell of cat, though it looks like he hasn't been here long, maybe only since Breeden's death. There's also a body. "Old," Abdul tells Thomas. "You don't want to look at it if you don't have to, but of course you have to. A decade at least, and I'm surprised there's this much left of it." Thomas looks unflinchingly. He's seen worse. This one is, after all, most definitely dead. So dead, there's little chance of telling much about him, or her possibly, from anything short of full forensic examination. The space is cylindrical, maybe 60 feet deep and 20 across. You can descend to the bottom via a metal staircase, as well as a lift that may or may not work. Certainly nobody's using it. "So," asks May, "what is this?" "I have no idea," Thomas tells her. "There's nothing obviously magical about it." He looks at Kumar. "Is this something to do with your quiet people?" "They're not mine exactly," he says. "Oh, nah, not at all. You'd know if you'd ever seen their tunnels. This is something else." "Constructed during Crossrail," somebody said. "Seems to have been, and then abandoned. 15 years ago, maybe." "Yeah, maybe," Kumar says. "What's that got to do with anything?" May frowns. "You know something." "I suspect something, but it circles back to the reason I was pulled off this in the first place," Thomas says. Fuck, May sighs. "It would do. If I ask your apprentices, they know the basics. Meanwhile, what's happening with Miller? Did he say anything when you took him in?" "Now that I'm definitely not supposed to tell you," she says. "But he didn't. Barely even acknowledged his own name, so there's nothing you don't know anyway." "What is the reason you were pulled off this?" Kumar wants to know, if you don't mind me asking. Thomas looks away. "Miller may have been eyewitness to an incident that resulted in multiple fatalities over a decade ago." "I heard that," says May. "What's their argument? You can't be trusted near him." "They can't seem to decide between that and wanting to let him go because I think the victim deserved what he got, actually." May looks surprisingly thoughtful. "That ties into some other things I've heard." She shakes her head when Thomas and Kumar look at her inquiringly. "Nope, don't have the time to stand around gossiping." Thomas translates this as, "I'm more worried about what happens to me if I tell you than you being annoyed with me for not saying anything." Kumar looks at him, then glances away. And Thomas wishes he had a better explanation, wishes he knew what to say in a way they'd understand. "In any case," Thomas says, "the job's not done." "Excuse you," says May. "We've made an arrest. There's half a dozen lines of evidence saying he did it. What about that's not done?" "I need to know what put Breeden and Miller in contact," Thomas says. "That's the part that really might concern me in my unit. I understand I'm not allowed near him, but if I could at least..." "Nope," says May. "Nope, nope, and also no. We've made an arrest. Odds on we'll get a conviction if we can get him in front of a court without it turning into a three-ring circus. Unless you've got evidence of another actual crime, I don't care. Take it up with somebody else." She walks away. "Get one of your constables to interview him," Kumar suggests. "Sounds like that'll fly." "Yes," says Thomas, "maybe. In the meantime, he's going to try something else." Over the years, Thomas has generally avoided most of the Met's internal politics by the simple expedient of ignoring it. In technical terms, he's part of specialist crime, but he's always reported directly to the commissioner. He's never bothered aiming lower when he needed something, and there hasn't been that many occasions for it anyway. The average senior investigating officer, when confronted with the involvement of magic in their case, just wants him to finish and be gone as soon as possible. Of recent years, if it can be thrown onto his budget as well, it makes them positively happy. Grant had said, if there's anything I can do, though, so it has to be worth a shot. Even if approaching him over this makes Thomas feel vaguely like he's mixing the personal and the professional. All right, what is it? Grant says in clipped tones when Thomas is let into his office. Is this a bad time? Thomas asks. No, Grant sighs, slouching down in his chair, in so much as it's the type that allows for slouching. Yes, not really. I just had the fun kind of advisory group meeting and I can't even yell at the people responsible. Have a seat. Thomas takes one. Is it the fun kind one, where you take responsibility for our organisation's wrongdoings in general? How did you guess? Says Grant. The usual kind of thing. Wait, you probably don't have a lot of contact with the usual kind of thing. Idiots at ground level harassing people, and their direct supervisors not thinking that it's important. I don't see why you can't reprimand the responsible parties directly. Firstly, that would be the worst sort of overkill. We're talking about constables and PCSOs. Secondly, I can't afford to be that person. Grant folds his arms, smiles a little grimly. You might get away with it. I've got to be in control. It's about what it looks like in the back of people's heads. Thomas thinks he gets what Grant is sketching out. Doesn't quite understand it at an intuitive level, but nods anyway. I see, I think. It doesn't help anyway, says Grant. Yelling, getting angry, all the rest of it. They've done studies. You'd know if you ever did any of the management training courses. Letting out aggression like that just reinforces it. Wouldn't fix them. Wouldn't help me. Thomas would rather walk back into a battle than a management training course. It's amazing what they've done studies on these days. Grant snorts. Your scepticism is noted. Okay, back to my first question. What is it? DPS still have you on the bench? I know Miller's in custody. Your friend Leslie thinks that's the end of it. Done and dusted, Thomas says. It's not. We still don't have a motive. Grant nods. What do you want exactly? To interview him. I can't make that happen, Grant says immediately. DPS won't have it. One of the apprentices, yeah, but you don't need me for that. You just need to get Leslie to... Oh, okay, maybe you do need me for that. Not in your official position so much, but... You know, the funny thing is, you and Leslie have a lot in common, really. Grant smirks at Thomas's expression. Fine, you don't think so. What's so important about Miller, apart from him being a loose end from the Berwick Street thing? I don't think he's important in himself at all, Thomas says. I think it's Breeden, and I want to know what Breeden said to him, why he panicked. You think he panicked? Hard to tell at this remove, but we haven't precisely had a rash of mauled corpses around the city. Either he's good at hiding bodies, or this is the first time he's killed somebody. Grant thinks about this. Okay, I'll talk to Leslie, but I want to talk about something else too. What's going to happen to him now? Technically, that's neither of our decision, Thomas feels obliged to point out. Grant gives him a look. How we handle this is definitely going to impact ongoing relations with the wider community, if you'll excuse the jargon, which makes it absolutely my problem. And they'll take your recommendations for lack of better options, I think. What would have happened in the past? Shot on sight, Thomas says, tries not to wince at the way Grant's face goes perfectly neutral. Yeah, no. Grant drums his fingers on the desk. He's been arrested on suspicion of murder. He did it, obviously, or... Wait, are you sure there isn't more than one cat person running around? The contrary, from what we've found. But there's DNA evidence. Good enough for now. Murder? Assault on a police officer while we're at it. Probably a bunch of minor stuff. The point is, he's due a trial, same as anybody else. I don't care about magic or chimeras or the rest of it. The charges are for the CPS to lay and a judge and jury get to decide whether he's guilty. But how we possibly pull it off? There is no judge or jury that will give him a fair hearing, not to mention the rest of it. If he's found guilty, as he undoubtedly would be. Jesus Christ, said Grant. He was used for illegal medical experimentation. He's been hiding for 15 years and we can't eat... Fine. What do you think we should do? Thomas has to take a moment for that, just to look at Grant. Uniform tie a bit askew, frowning thoughtfully, utterly convinced that they have a duty of care, that they owe Jacob Miller something. That's Grant's real gift, he's starting to think. He looks at London and considers himself bound to everybody in it, doesn't stop to question it or draw dividing lines between the deserving and undeserving. Plea negotiation, perhaps, he says. There's room for it not to go to public trial in exceptional circumstances, which we could certainly cite. The sentence might not even have to be reduced all that much. I doubt Miller is interested in becoming a matter of public record either. I hate those, Grant says bluntly. Never should have been made possible in the first place. It puts power in all the wrong places. Nevertheless, Thomas says, I've considered it before, though there's never been an applicable situation. I know it's not ideal. I don't think we're in any doubt about his guilt. The point is that whether we're in doubt shouldn't decide what happens to him. We're not judge, jury and executioner. Are we not supposed to be? Look, what I'm worried about, what I'm trying to ask, is how are the community going to take this? I don't know, says Thomas. Historically, that wasn't something we worried about, unless it looked likely to lead to violence. I don't think they expect much, to be frank. What's the last time you had something like this? Grant wants to know. That you had people you could arrest for a specific, straightforward crime. You know, murder, that sort of thing. Barbara Tamonina, Thomas says without hesitation. But she was a practitioner, not anything else, so it wasn't quite... There is a general expectation that I'm responsible for practitioners, regardless of whether they're trained in the Newtonian, the British, tradition. In fact, when it comes to the confrontation at Berwick Street, I know you've read the file. I was given to understand later that nobody much cared what I did to or with that faceless, with a rogue magician who had ultimately been trained by a former folly member. It was seen as an internal dispute. But it wasn't just him. Other people got caught in the crossfire. Thomas nods. If you like, that was probably the last time there's any question of being required to arrest anybody magical for a, how did you put it, a simple, straightforward crime. After that, I think people started keeping their heads down, even further down. I read the report, says Grant, and I read the inquiry report from DPS. The fact that nobody appears to give a shit what the magical community think is why you kept your job, as far as I can tell. That and you convinced them your rogue magician was a genuine and serious danger. Don't make that face. I wasn't casting aspersions. Based on what I know, you weren't wrong. Thomas wasn't aware he was making any sort of face, but Grant has at some point got dangerously good at reading him. Then again, you know all that, because that's why you got pulled off this case now. It was a loose thread for somebody to pull, with Miller at the heart of it, if I'm not mistaken. What's your point, sir? Grant spreads a hand, palm up. Tell me your side of it. You said you'd read the report. Reports are for senior officers and inquiries. You're one of those things. Grant just looks at him expectantly, face calm. Thomas takes a breath. It started when... No, that's not right. It started in the spring, when a ghost went on a killing spree all across London. He sketches out the punch case briefly, the possessions and deaths... The way he'd been two steps behind for almost all of it. The Covent Garden riot and fires. That was a ghost! Grant is genuinely startled. I was a probationer at Charing Cross when that was kicking off. Unconnected murders, I thought. Well, that was the story we stuck to, says Thomas. The thing is, I didn't solve that one. Not really. The spirit, whatever it was, it played out its game and then it ran out of story. Or attention or energy, I don't know. I didn't exorcise it or anything like that. Do you really do exorcisms? Grant seems to find this funny. No priest required. Grant does let out a soft laugh. All right, how does this relate? Possessions, Thomas says. Remember Abdul's brain collection? All the victims, the possessed, their brains looked like that when the spirit was done with them. Then a couple of months later, he sent the vestigia on a corpse and checked the brain. It was drained of magic in the same way. It's not unique to possession by a ghost. Victims and vampires have the same symptoms. But in the absence of any other usual signs, like being drained of blood. Oh no, the human body has more blood than they can consume. It's a much messier process than that. Grant makes a face. Well, I asked. Not vampires. You went looking for a ghost again? It was a possibility, says Thomas. What I found was three women who'd been alive since the Café de Paris bombing in 1941. It seemed to be they inspelled jazz musicians, drained magic from them. Sometimes the musicians died. Sometimes they were just left permanently damaged. From the barely noticeable to severe impairment. Lots of cases of drug and alcohol addiction, that sort of thing. This time it's his turn to read something barely noticeable on Grant's face. He remembers abruptly their conversation about Grant's father. Can't quite remember how his career had ended, but surely... This is not at all the time for that, though, if ever. It wasn't like vampires, he hastens on. Otherwise, they seem to go about quite normal lives. I interviewed one briefly, and I knew there was something off, something magical, but not... It wasn't what I expected. They had jobs. They shopped for groceries. They liked to listen to the Archers, somebody told me. And they all lived together in a flat in Berwick Street. So you went to arrest them? No, Thomas says. This is important. He mustn't get it wrong. Even if Grant's not going to like it, not one bit. I went to kill them. It didn't go as planned. He pauses. Grant folds his arms. Okay. Apparently that's a prompt to continue. I expected a nest, like you get with vampires. I expected you got Annie to tell you. Everything's dead around a vampire nest, even the bacteria in the soil, so I'm told. I thought it would be obvious where they lived. I got there and they had flowers, not fresh ones, a few days old. You couldn't get that with vampires. It's not possible. He still remembers it, opening the door to the flat, every sense on high alert, and seeing the flowers on the table. They weren't even in a vase, just shoved carelessly into a glass jar. One or two petals fallen to the tabletop. Like a bucket of cold water over his head, he'd known it was wrong. It was all wrong. No tactus disvitae, no death. There was vestigia right enough, the smell of honeysuckle and brick dust faint on the air, the same thing he'd sensed around Simone Fitzwilliam. But whatever this was, burning the nest out wasn't going to work. Maybe even Frank and his boys on standby with their helicopter wasn't going to be the right approach. It was only being on high alert that saved him when the chimera had sprung at him from behind. He'd knocked the creature down the stairs, but the sight of it had said that something else was wrong, very wrong indeed. And when he'd arrived on the rooftop to find the three women clustered there being lectured to by a man who hid his face with magic, he'd started to get the outline of what it was that might be wrong. He wasn't expecting me. Didn't know who I was until I told him my name. And then he thought it was funny, or fortunate even, that he deserved a chance to test himself, by which he meant beating me in a magical duel, killing me, I think. God knows he didn't scruple at that from everything else we found later. He owned up to the chimera I'd encountered at the entrance to the flat. That was enough. Enough for what? Asks Grant. Enough to condemn him, Thomas says. There's no way to get the magic you need to do something like that without killing for it. There just isn't, not for human practitioners. And before you ask, as far as I know, there's no way to get somebody who's not a human practitioner to volunteer theirs. Involuntarily? Well, Ettersburg had shown that was another story. No need to mention that. That being said, if at all possible, I wanted to arrest him. I needed to know where he'd come from, what he thought he was doing, why he thought he could get away with it. Why he didn't even know who you were, when you were supposed to be the person who keeps people like him from happening, Grant says, a little dryly. Well, I think in retrospect he may have been under the impression I was dead. Anyway, he was good, very good, a genuine master of the art. He didn't expect me to be up to his standard. When he realised he wasn't going to win, he tried to make a break for it. You're telling me you had a knock-down, drag-out magical duel on a rooftop in Soho and it didn't make YouTube? Anybody close enough to get a good view would have had their device destroyed by magic. And you're just that good. He knew he couldn't win. Thomas has been in plenty of fights, but every one is a fight you can lose. This had been no different. But 90% of how he gets his job done by now is the impression that he won't lose, not one of confidence but of knowledge. I went to war before his parents were born, he says. He'd never been in a magical duel before, so far as I can figure. With whom and when? So no, he wasn't going to win, and he realised it. And when he tried to get away, I went in pursuit. Is this where the suspects you were there for re-enter the picture? Suspects is such an innocuous way to put it. They hadn't gone far. They were arguing at the bottom of the stairs. I'm still not sure what about. I think they thought... They wondered if they should help. That wasn't in the report, Grant says quietly. It's speculation at best, Thomas admits, and I don't know who they wanted to help. They may have just thought they needed to defend themselves against the winner. Then the fight starts again and they die in the crossfire, right? Thomas doesn't think he'd made it sound like that. It didn't happen like that. That would have been simpler. He tried, he says. The magician, I mean. He tried to use them as hostages. You keep not saying his name. It doesn't mean anything. What he was had been more important than who in that moment, if Thomas had even had a name to give him. Of course there'd been one after, and that had caused half the trouble. Wait, Grant says, standing up to pace forward and back a step or two behind his desk. The suspects, these women, jazz vampires or whatever they were, they couldn't defend themselves. You said they were draining people's magic. I don't think so, Thomas says slowly. In retrospect, in light of what happened, I don't think they knew what they were doing. I don't think it was intentional. And you still went in there intending to... In retrospect, Thomas emphasizes, it wasn't until they didn't do anything when in danger that it became apparent that might be the case. I never got the chance to talk to any of them, not really. So, says Grant. He leans against his chair, arms still folded. His eyes are very hard. What then? I told him, Thomas tries to keep his voice neutral, that I was there to arrest them, that they were suspects for murder, what I thought they were. Did it take you that long to figure it out? The magician had said, like he thought Thomas was slow or careless. Maybe he had been. Of course, that's what they are. One of them had gasped. The other one had shaken her head. No, we wouldn't. We don't want to hurt anybody. Of course you don't, the magician had said soothingly. But she'd flinched back as if he tried to touch her. It was like he'd forgotten for a second. He was theoretically holding them hostage to Thomas's acquiescence. I told him, Thomas says, not in the words he'd used for the report, but the weary truth. I told him I couldn't let him go, that he'd done things that couldn't be allowed to go on. I told him saving them wasn't more important to me than that, that they were what I was there to protect people from. You thought he'd let them go if they weren't useful, Grant says quietly, and Thomas isn't stupid. He can recognise an interrogation when he's on the wrong side of it. Too late to stop, though, even if he wanted to. I was telling him the truth. Let's not put a better face on it. But it is true, if you like, that I didn't think he'd kill them. He'd been trying to recruit them, I thought. If they weren't useful as hostages, they may be useful as minions, Grant says immediately, and then apparently thinks better of it. Ah, but you were wrong. But I was wrong. Thomas has seen and been responsible for more deaths than he likes to think about. It's not pretty when you add it up, even considering the war. So he can't even say that these were the worst. They're certainly not the only ones he could have in theory prevented. They're not even in the category of things he truly regrets, but they're the ones he has to recount right now. He killed them. We fought. I killed him. It's not much more complicated than that. Grant wipes a hand over his face. Do you remember when I asked you why you were a police officer? Thomas nods. I remember what I told you. What else would I be? After the war, when everybody else was gone, everything else the folly had done, most of it had no purpose anymore. The things that were left, policing was the closest thing to it. And you said, this isn't policing. And for some of it, you weren't wrong. There are certain priorities held by the modern Met, in theory, if somewhat intermittently in practice, that everybody has the same rights, that officers must carry out their duties without fear or favour, that they owe everyone the same treatment and justice. The Follies' priorities had never been that. You know, you saying that to me, that's the only reason, Grant says and trails off. Is that it? The end of what happened from your point of view? My backup arrived, Thomas says. That's not really in the report, because it upsets the DPS too much. Not SCO-19. Reservists from the infantry unit that was with us in the last battle of the war. Not something we needed before then. But when it was down to just me. Grant groans. No, Jesus Christ, please do not tell me any more about paramilitary troops running around London for the sake of plausible deniability of nothing else. Okay, ignoring the details of who, did they see much of what happened? Just the aftermath. And the Chimera, Grant says, the one you knocked down the stairs, was that Miller? I have no idea. He was gone by the time Frank Caffrey and... By the time anybody else got there. We looked at the time, but never found him. And then, when we did find the Soho Club, that blew everything else out of the water. If you had found him, then, what was the plan? I don't know, Thomas says. I don't have an answer. There was certainly more than one Chimera held at the club. We never found any of them. We never had to have a plan because of that. Some or all of them were probably victims of sex trafficking based on some of what we've found. Jesus, Grant says again. Yeah, I remember that part of the report because it needed to get worse. Miller, no idea, Thomas says. No way to tell, unless he decides to talk about any of that, which right now he's not. A lawyer might be able to help him figure out what he does and doesn't want to say. When he gets assigned one. If and when one can be found, he'll take the case and not. Do you know if there's anybody who deals with magic, come to that? Some firm is a speciality for? You can't tell me Tyburn doesn't have lawyers. Even if I did, I couldn't recommend them. Conflict of interest. But that's never been a concern. Right. Grant rubs his jaw. For future reference, it probably should be. People who can't tell the defence counsel the truth about what happened, whether or not they're telling the truth otherwise, that's not reasonable. The problem is, in general, Thomas says, nobody is keen for the general public to find out any of the issues we deal with. Not me, not the Commissioner, not the Home Office, certainly not anybody within the Demimonde. Even someone like Tyburn. Her problem is not being in charge of dealing with these issues. She wouldn't want them as a matter of public record. A ministry for magic, says Grant, and then, sorry, I'm sure you've heard that joke before. Once or twice, Thomas allows. Grant huffs a soft laugh, finally retakes his seat. What I've heard, he says, is that Miller will be kept in solitary confinement for now while something is figured out, which can't go on forever because that's its own form of cruel and unusual punishment. But for the moment, yes, that always has been the problem. What are you going to do? Have a special jail? How many steps is it from there to Ettersburg? Fewer than Thomas likes to think about. That seems like a reasonable first step. Keep thinking about it, Grant advises. I'm going to be. You can't have the respect of the community if you can't treat certain people in it equally. You just can't. You need better solutions. That's becoming apparent. They're both silent for a moment. It got around, didn't it? Grant says. Berwick Street, what happened? Some of it, and people didn't trust you anymore. Do you mean the Demimonde or the Met? Yeah. Yes, Thomas says. I think so. I don't know how, but yes. Grant's as good as his word. Not that Thomas expected less. Abigail is called to sit in on an interview with Miller the next day. Thomas doesn't learn this directly, and he comes back to the folly and tells Mal, in a conversation that technically doesn't include him. They both glance over at him so often that he's tempted to tell them to get on with it. He doesn't, of course. Not verbally, anyway. As far as DCI May's concerned, the case really is wrapped up now, Abigail tells everybody that evening. She's got a confession. That's all she wants. My bit of the interview isn't on record. What did he have to say for himself? Abigail pulls out her notebook. Thomas finds it obscurely satisfying that they've all returned to using paper and pen. The electronics problem making digital forms of notation impractical. It's not that he doesn't appreciate modern technology, but some of it feels like change for the sake of change. He didn't really want to talk, she says, leafing through to the right page, about much at all. He's not very... It's hard for him to speak, I think, with his mouth and everything. Here we go. I told him he just wanted to know what Breeden wanted. Was it... says Mal. Oh, no, thank God, says Abigail. He said eventually that Breeden said they might be able to help each other and then... Okay, he got sidetracked into worrying what was going to happen to him. What is going to happen to him? Annie wants to know. May didn't say. Still to be decided, as far as I'm aware, Thomas says, thinking about his conversation with Grant. There's not a lot of precedent. He was worried about treating like a freak, Abigail says bluntly, or experimented on, or things like that. But he was more worried about wizards, about us than the police. Thomas can guess why. Did you get him back on track? Yeah. Abigail closes the notebook, apparently having refreshed her memory. Breeden wanted to know about something that happened 15 years ago, someone he'd seen getting killed. And he wouldn't say anything else, but I think... It sounds like he didn't want to talk about it. And Breeden made noises about all that stuff he was worried about, getting locked up or whatever, and he panicked. That is more or less what Thomas expected at this point. But why now? What was Breeden's plan? And he didn't say why Breeden was asking about this. I think he didn't care, says Abigail. She looks at him. 15 years ago, was this your faceless magician? Is that what he wanted to know about? I can only assume so, says Thomas. What relevance it might suddenly have now, I don't know. After a great deal of consultation, Miller is remanded for psychiatric assessment. It's the best Thomas can come up with, and it's agreed to up the chain. Is there any evidence he's actually mentally unstable? Grant wants to know. I get there aren't any better options. I couldn't think of any. Not in the conventional sense, no, Thomas says, but it allows the whole thing, and him, to be quietly shuffled to one side for the moment. His appearance can be explained away as plastic surgery, combined with, there's a condition, I don't remember the exact term, excessive hair growth. Hypertrichosis, says Grant at once. How do you even read about it somewhere? I don't know. That'll work, and the plastic surgery argument makes him look even less mentally stable for assessment, which, Grant grimaces, fantastic. I foresee a lot of complaints about our attitude to mental illness, depending on how much media coverage this gets. Not unreasonably. At least I'm not specifically responsible for that area. Thomas shrugs. We have to have some explanation. Leslie's going to be furious. She wanted a conviction, Thomas agrees. She hates it every time she has a case connected to me and doesn't get one. I sometimes suspect she's keeping a tally. She is, says Grant absently, and then looks concerned. Do not tell her I told you that. Thomas has to laugh at that. Grant cracks a sheepish grin. It's comfortable, but then Thomas has to look away. He doesn't know exactly where he stands with Grant now. Asking him for help seems to have returned them to a purely professional footing, and he suspects, still, that there are things Grant isn't telling him. But Grant doesn't seem to see it that way. Instead, Thomas starts getting text messages from him, a tentative connection. Thomas has never been quite sure of the utility of text messages, vastly prefers actual conversation, but Grants don't usually demand an answer. They're just there. How are the constables doing? Grant will say. Apprentices, Thomas responds. The apprentices are progressing surprisingly well. Apples are exploding all over the lab. Is that good? It's a sign of progress. Have you got them safety goggles?
Safety goggles?
The next message is a picture of a standard pair of lab safety goggles, followed by, are you kidding me? Yes, Thomas responds. Yes, you're kidding me, or yes, you're providing them with safety equipment. Yes. Thomas is beginning to get the impression Annie must have been quite circumspect when she told Grant about the vampire nest. He can't imagine Grant not having something to say about the use of phosphorus grenades. Who put you in charge of people? Whose genius idea was that? Grant responds. And Thomas is partially quite offended and partially aware that it's 11 o'clock at night and judging by the hours at which he's received some of these messages, Grant hasn't been getting a lot of sleep recently. I believe it was yours, he responds. And it's not really a surprise when the front doorbell rings 15 minutes later and it's Grant. I have no idea what I'm actually doing here, Grant admits. It was just getting unsatisfying telling you off in 150 characters or less. Tea? Thomas offers. You know that there's almost as much caffeine in black tea as in coffee, right? Which makes that an appallingly bad idea this time of night, says Grant. Why not? Molly has gone to bed, or at least left the kitchen. Thomas knows she doesn't really sleep very much, so Thomas deals with the teapot himself, while Grant half dozes at the kitchen table, head propped against a fist. It's almost domestic. You've been busy, Thomas says while the tea brews. That happens, Grant says, changing position to hang one arm over the back of his chair. His jacket is undone and his tie slightly askew, and he looks younger than he ever has. Honestly, I'm not good when it's not busy. My brain starts going in circles. I notice you've been keeping your head down since the Miller thing. That happens, Thomas says, fetching down mugs. It's like any sort of crime. Things ebb and flow. It's good, since you've seen fit to provide me with four people to train. Best start as we mean to go on, says Grant. 10 years, you said, and then if there's two of you at the end? Fantastic. If you get hit by a bus, we're in the same place we started. And that's assuming you don't rejoin the rest of us on the slow frog march towards old age. This way you might actually think about expanding. Thomas blinks at him, considering this. It's late, after all. What do you want out of this, sir? What I told you, Grant says. For you to be able to do it right, or try to. It's not complicated. Thomas thinks it's very complicated indeed, but forbears saying so on account of the hour. They sit for a while in silence and pretend to sip their tea. Grant was right. It is an appallingly bad idea at this hour. I was serious about the safety equipment, Grant says eventually. There's been about 3 rounds of changes to the health and safety reg since I joined, let alone since you started. We have a responsibility to proactively prevent accidents now. I realised, when were you learning magic? This stuff you're teaching them? Shortly before the Great War, says Thomas. Yeah, I thought as much. Just look up the regs. Think about what you can do. This needs to be... We've only got so much leeway for it. You know that, right? If one of them gets hurt seriously, the commissioner might just call it all off. Cecilia Tyburn, she might... You're not the only alternative anymore. Maybe you haven't been for years. I don't know if you realise that. Thomas looks at him coolly. I do realise that. Would you consider that an acceptable outcome? Grant looks down into his mug like it has an answer. I'm withholding judgment. He looks up. Sorry, I know you want a better answer, but right now it's the truth. I do appreciate that, Thomas says carefully. It's not personal, says Grant. I didn't think it was. I should go. Grant doesn't write away, though. They sit there for another 10 minutes at least. Thomas wishes he knew what he wanted. It might make things simpler. Grant's mention of Tyburn concerns him. He hasn't heard anything from her for months now, despite his assumption she was responsible for pushing him off the case. It makes him uneasy. There's no official case anymore for him to investigate, and he doesn't have access to the records from it anyway. He's still circumscribed from it, even if it's not an active investigation, so he has to start with what he knows. He could just get the apprentices to do it, but that doesn't seem reasonable. That resolve lasts until Annie walks in on him trying to reconstruct the timeline for Breeden on the chalkboard in the lecture theatre they never use. What are you doing in... Oh! She has to take a few steps back to read all of it. Sir, do you want me to fill that in a bit, maybe? I'm still not allowed in the Miller case, he reminds her. I'm not asking any of you to... Oh, right, yes. She taps her foot. Do you know, I came to find you because Mal needs your help in the lab. Is that so? Yes, Annie nods. Right now. Very important. Please, sir. Thomas looks at the chalkboard, looks at Annie, considers the likelihood of having to avoid files left accidentally open on the computer and papers spread across the library table for the next however long, and decides discretion is the greater portion of valour. Mal is, of course, not even in the lab. But that's hardly the point. The thing Thomas hones in on once he's taken in Annie's annotations, not only hers, he's fairly sure, but it's all in her handwriting, is Harrison, Breeden's Oxford friend. He'd been in the States when the murder occurred, but was interviewed briefly, not by Annie or Abigail, more's the pity. Thomas had looked into him 15 years ago and crossed him off as a potential problem. There had been financial ties between him and some of the companies involved with the Skygarden end of things. Not that Thomas had ever quite got to the bottom of that, but no evidence he'd continued as an active practitioner. Still, he's the only other member of the Little Crocodiles tied to this case as far as Thomas knows. He dispenses with pretense and invites suggestions from the apprentices over supper for further lines of inquiry, laying forth briefly the history of the group at Oxford, but keeping back, for now, those words of Grant's. You're not the only alternative. Abigail pounces on the financial end of things, understandably giving her background. Did fraud or organised crime ever go anywhere with that? No, Thomas says. I don't think there was anything prosecutable. Some ties to some rather questionable Russians. SFO, she suggests. Trying to get public housing destroyed? They might be interested. Matt says something incomprehensible through a mouthful of cottage pie, and everybody waits for him to swallow. It's still there, though, Skygarden Estate. That big ugly thing in Southwark, right? Of course it is. Sky lives there, says Mal. You know, Nikki's friend. They're her trees. Nobody's going to let it get knocked down if her trees are there. That would kill her, probably, Thomas says. Gina Illicorum are by no means invulnerable. But to answer your question, Abigail, you know perfectly well police investigations are kept entirely separate from serious fraud officers' work, said Thomas. I doubt they'd be willing to cooperate, even if we haven't opened an official investigation yet. Officially, no, says Abigail smugly. Thomas eyes her. Would it be helpful if I ask you to elaborate on that? Abigail purses her lips. It probably wouldn't hurt. Thomas gestures for her to go on. My DS when I was in fraud, she says. His partner's an FSO investigator. He knows a bunch of other SFO people. He likes me. I think he'd be willing to ask them quietly. As long as it won't be suspicious, Thomas concedes. Nah, she says. He wasn't my direct supervisor. Is this the one who had all those crazy stories? Matt wants to know, including the one about jumping off the building into the swimming pool, which I just do not believe, says Abigail. That's him. Why not? Says Mal. Better than jumping off onto concrete. He claims it was like 10 stories. Annie taps the end of her fork on the table, frowning. Magic? It would take a very skilled practitioner to survive that, Thomas says. I think I'd have noticed them, if they were in the Met, probably. Oh well, says Mal. There goes my dreams of leaping tall buildings in a single bound. Right now you can't walk up the stairs in a single bound, says Matt, and then ow, when at a guess, Annie kicks him under the table. Mal's still not happy about her rate of recovery. It doesn't take Abigail long to come back with something. So, nothing official, she says, but Breeden and the other guy were meeting with someone. Guess who? Thomas holds out his hand, unwilling to play this game. Hold on, I couldn't take stuff away with me. Just had to take a photo, she says. Also, I think we owe them a favour now. Sorry. Who's they? Fraud, says Abigail. Also the SFO. She holds out her phone. It's a picture of a picture, obviously taken with a telephoto lens. Breeden is barely recognisable. And it's not so much Lady Ty who Thomas recognises, though he does recognise her. It's her car. So the question is, Abigail says, what does Lady Ty want with some Oxford graduates who used to play around with magic? An alternative, says Thomas, to the folly. But we can't go anywhere with this. It's not evidence of anything. No, Thomas agrees. We need someone else they've talked to. The other one, Harrison, he was on a business trip to the States. Is that it? Related to this, perhaps, given the timing. I didn't look into that. You'd have to ask Annie, says Abigail, but yeah. California? Yeah, why is that important? I think, Thomas says, I might know who we need to talk to next. Richard Lewis was one of the best sources of information he'd had when he was trying to sort through the debris of Berwick Street. The metaphorical, not the literal. More than willing, once it had been made plain to him that the connection was known, to explain everything he'd ever heard about his old university friend turned black magician. Unfortunately, he hadn't known enough to explain what the man had wanted with Sky Garden Estate, and nothing about the building had made it any clearer to Thomas. Sky's presence and her trees surely couldn't be it. But Thomas had come away convinced Lewis mostly wanted to get as far away from magic as he could. Shortly afterwards, he'd quit his job with Southwark Council and moved to California, his husband's place of origin, making him emphatically not Thomas's problem. It's possible that there are other former little crocodiles lurking in the United States, and Harrison's trip may have had nothing to do with it, but it's worth looking into. And, having investigated him all those years ago, finding that his return to the home country for a visit is the perfect excuse for Thomas to go and speak with him. He takes Mal. She's chafing at the bit to get out and do something, and she's officially off medical leave. Lewis is clearly nervous to see Thomas again after all these years. He looks much the same as he did then. Older, less hair, the usual sort of thing. He exchanges a worried look with his husband, an American of Asian descent, whom Thomas hadn't met when he'd interviewed Lewis before, but doesn't refuse to speak to him, and Mal without a lawyer. That's a start. Inspector Nightingale, says Lewis nervously once they're all seated. He hasn't offered them anything to drink. Probably wants to get rid of them as soon as possible. And PC Malini Chowdhury, Thomas introduces her. Mal smiles brightly and inoffensively. I'll make this quick, if it's possible. You were visited recently by a friend from your Oxford days. He doesn't know that for a fact, but it's a hit. Lewis stiffens. Yes, what about it? You won't be surprised to learn, says Thomas. Any association between members of your group is of interest to us. It wasn't illegal. Lewis goes on the defensive right away. It was just, he had a business proposition. You must know all about that. I thought it was because you were retiring or... But you look exactly the same as you did the last time you interviewed me. And that was before my kids were born. Thomas had spotted them briefly, through a window. Teenagers are very close to it. He'd never been good with estimating children's ages. They must have come along quite soon after Lewis had emigrated. Police work's good for the skin, Mal says deadpan. Thomas flicks her an irritated glance, but she doesn't look terribly repentant. Would you care to elaborate on that? Lewis doesn't look like he would, but he does anyway. You know, the consulting thing on magical stuff. I said no, I wouldn't be interested in that sort of thing anyway. I have a job and I like it, and after... You know what happened.
That's all.
I do, says Thomas. And the thought that any of Wheatcroft's students could credibly do my job. You can't have thought this was a plan I condoned. I don't know what you have against the rest of us, Lewis says, setting his jaw. You use magic. We might not have been doing it in the service of the country or whatever, but we weren't hurting anybody, and it was just a bit of fun. Parlour tricks, really. Apart from, well, you can't judge us all by. Did Wheatcroft ever teach you about demon traps? Thomas asks. I know he taught at least one or two of you, because I've had to disarm them. No, Lewis says cautiously. That sounds unpleasant. The Vikings invented them, says Thomas. You torture somebody to death and trap their ghost. Unpleasant is the least of it. Beside him, he feels Mel wince. He wouldn't have... He used dogs, Thomas says. I suppose that's better. But I think you should ask yourself if, at least he wasn't torturing and killing other human beings on a regular basis, is the best thing you can say of somebody, and you want to not be judged by association with them. None of that was anything to do with me, says Lewis, now looking sick. I was terrified of him, I told you. He would have killed me, I think. You asked, Thomas says, what the difference was between me and all of you. I swore an oath. What were you sworn to, any of you, apart from your own amusement? Things don't have to be serious like that, Lewis tries to argue. It's not the 19th century anymore. It was just... Anyway, it's a shame, isn't it? One day you're going to die, and then nobody's going to know all this stuff at all. I thought that's what it was. You were retiring and there wasn't anybody else. That's all, I swear. The world is rather wider than that, says Thomas. Also, I'm right here, says Mal. I bet I'm better at magic than you already. You said you haven't done it for 30 years. He's not the last wizard in England anymore. I wasn't ever, really, Thomas says, amused. But not even officially. Not now. You, says Lewis. Oh, it's hard to look down your nose at somebody with 3 or more inches of height on you, especially when you're both sitting down. But Mal manages it quite efficiently. Anyway, Lewis says, John asked me. I said no. That's everything I know about it. I don't want anything to do with it, all this stuff. I have a family. I have kids. I have a life a long way from here. Did he say, Thomas presses, why they were so confident this scheme would work out? I don't think it was their scheme, really, says Lewis, even if I hadn't wanted to. It was something to do with the river, they said. I didn't really get that part. Which river? The Tyburn. But I figured that was a code name or for something or someone. Not... Never mind, says Thomas. Mal catches his eye, her whole body tense. That's what I needed to know. Tyburn was trying to replace him with a little crocodiles. He can fill in that much. Thomas wonders why this feels so much more like an injury, even a betrayal, than every other time she's tried to shuffle him out of the way in the last 2 decades. But he knows why. It's the scream of demon traps, the rustle of red velvet curtains, the sound of bodies falling to the ground. The question is, would he consider... He can't worry about that now. He knows what he has to do. He's been putting this off for years, hoping Tyburn's effort to define herself through politics and bureaucratic manoeuvring will fizzle out, or at least turn away from trying to define herself in opposition to the folly. The moment he has to go to the goddess of the river and demand that she rein in her daughter, he's admitting he can't do it himself. He suspects that someone else, Peter Grant, say, might see it differently. But Grant was right all those months ago about that tightrope he's ended up walking, and how easy it is to fall off. Maybe it wouldn't be very far, but he doesn't know what the consequences would end up being. The sensible thing would be to send one of the apprentices. But in the end, it's a problem that predates them, and there's the high chance Mother Thames would just demand he come himself anyway. Then he'd be attending on her request, and that isn't the tone he needs to set. So he tells them he's going out for the afternoon and gets in the jag and drives to Wapping. He does call ahead. There's a difference between arriving on one's own recognizance and arriving unannounced, and the greater genii lacorum have strong feelings about it. They're all there when he gets there, not just Tyburn, dangerous in a black skirt suit, but all the rest of the river's many daughters. He doesn't know all of them well, if any, but he recognises them. Ephra with her bright braids, Fleet with her captain of dogs at her feet, no good sign. Olympia and Chelsea almost indistinguishable in not quite the same outfits. Even young Brent, who is old enough to attend university now, and so not so young. It's intimidating at the same time, it's a wonder. When Thomas came to London a century ago, there was no Tyburn, no Fleet, no Ephra, not to mention all the rest of them. Just the painful echoes of their deaths, trickles running through sewers. Incongruously in her pearls and twinset, although back then it had been stayed in slightly old-fashioned morning dress of the style now called Edwardian, is the only one who was there then. Nobody from the Folly would have predicted this, and yet, here they all are. Thomas certainly wouldn't have predicted it after Ettersburg, when magic seemed almost gone. He's not sure whether he should feel the city is better for it, whether that's just the glamour speaking, but he thinks he does. It's not just the goddess of the river and her daughters there, though. Oxley is there next to Tyburn, confident but perhaps not entirely happy, standing out like a sore and very pale thumb with his hay thatch hair. That really isn't a good sign. The sons and daughters of the Thames tolerate each other, but they act together cautiously, if at all. Beverley Brook is standing to the right, with Neckinger and Rom and the other rivers of the South Bank. She presses her lips together and shakes her head as he passes, very slightly as if to avoid notice, although Neckinger obviously sees and is confused. He's not sure what she means by it, so he just nods to her. "Good afternoon," Thomas says when he arrives before Mother Thames. She is sitting in her armchair like a throne. Perhaps it is a throne, come to that. "What brings you here, Thomas Nightingale?" she asks. "It has been a long time since you showed your face last." "I have my job to do," he says. "I hear you approved of Constable Camara. I'm glad." "Well, I wouldn't go as far as all that," says the goddess of the river. "But she's a well-behaved girl. Not what I expected of an apprentice of yours." "I doubt any of them are, but they're mine nonetheless." "You didn't come here to gossip about your apprentices," she says. "So what is it you want?" "There is an agreement," Thomas begins, "between the Folly and the rivers. One of your daughters is trying to change that, to rid herself and perhaps you of the Folly. If you have a problem with it, bring it to my face. Don't send her to stab me in the back." "I have not sent any of my daughters to do that," she says. "Nor would I." "Tyburn, this is you, isn't it?" he's talking about. "Yes," Tyburn says, stepping forward. "It's not behind his back, though. I'm merely trying to make sure he gets the same checks and balances as anybody else. We all know what happened 15 years ago with that magician. A witness turned up to the confrontation, and the next thing you know, he's trying to arrest him." "He committed a murder," Thomas says. "He confessed to it. That's nothing to do with wherever he may have been that day. What matters is that controlling me isn't your business, Tyburn. It never has been, and you don't get to play both sides. I'm here to stand for the Met before the Demimonde." "What? Community policing now?" Tyburn sneers. "As if you know the first thing about that. You fumble around from on high. You don't even know half of what's really out there, but you pretend you do to people who know better." "There have been complaints." Oxley speaks for the first time. "You're not here for us. You're here for what doubtless you think of as the normal folk. How can we trust that you'll treat us fair when you said yourself you'd let those girls die to do your job? That's what the lad you arrested said." All the excuses aren't any good. Not to that. "I made the choices I had to make that day to try and rein in a problem the Folly created," Thomas says. "I took a gamble and I lost. Me by myself wasn't enough, and that's why I have apprentices now. I trust you don't have any complaints about them." "Apprentices," Tyburn's voice is very calm now. He doesn't think it's a sign he's out of danger. "Who you will no doubt teach to be the same as you. And where's the difference there?" "They can't be the same." He knows that for a fact. "The institutions that taught me and that I worked for are gone, and were gone before their grandparents were born." What he wants to say is that he doesn't want them to just do what he would do. He's still here, isn't he? What good would that be? What he needs in apprentices is people who know how to look at the world differently. But that feels like an admission he can't afford. Not to Tyburn, Not in this moment. If you mean they'll be Newtonian practitioners, well, I can hardly train them to be anything else. It doesn't seem you have any inherent objection to that, judging by the company you've been keeping lately. He thought, hoped, that might be a hit. Certainly Mother Thames narrows her eyes, and some of Tyburn's sisters turn their heads to look at her. He wishes he could see Beverly Brooke's face, but Tyburn doesn't even flinch. Of course not, she says. There'll always be wizards, whether you deign to notice them officially or not. But that's the problem, isn't it, Inspector Nightingale? You can't even control your own, short of destroying your rivals. You don't even pretend to. We had an agreement with the Folly once, but you were the power in the land, all the wizards of Britain. You don't represent that, not anymore, even with your new apprentices. So why should we be bound to an agreement with you? She turns to her mother, of course. Thomas isn't even the real audience for this speech, he realises with a chill. Mother Thames is, and Oxley, and everybody else in this room. Why should we? Mother Thames opens her mouth, and all of a sudden, Thomas can't predict what she'll say, doesn't know, but she's interrupted by a commotion at the back of the room. Thomas knows better than to look around, still, but he hears Beverly Brooke's voice rising clearly above the fray. They're here for the Nightingale. And he has to turn. He has to look then. It's Peter Grant, his uniform immaculately pressed and looking as confident as you please. Abigail shadows him in her best court suit, the effect tempered somewhat by the cloud of her hair, bound only cursorily at the back of her neck. There's nothing to tell on her face, but a hint of nerves in the way she has to move to keep up with Grant's long strides. Beverly stays to the back, her eyes tracking them, a hint of satisfaction in her smile. Grant arrives next to Thomas and removes his hat, tucking it under one arm. Mama Thames? Who, says Mother Thames, are you? Commander Peter Grant of the Metropolitan Police Service, responsible for community engagement. And what has that got to do, Mother Thames nods regally around the room, with me and mine? You have an officer of the Metropolitan Police here, says Grant. I understand the community, your community, has complaints as to his conduct. Properly speaking, that's my area. Commander, Thomas tries to break in, but Grant shoots him a sideways look. Did you have something to add to that, Inspector? No, Thomas says, and because if this is the game Grant wants to play, Thomas can't undermine him in it, sir. If you are here for the police, says the Goddess of the River, why did you bring another wizard with you? Abigail's a constable, and only an apprentice aside from that. She didn't really have a choice about what I asked her. Abigail is almost certainly glaring daggers at Grant for that, but Thomas didn't look. It would spoil the effect. With no disrespect, Commander, says Oxley surprisingly, I don't think you understand what's going on here. It's not really to do with the Metropolitan Police Service, and you're not... He trails off, frowns at Grant. This is the Nightingale's responsibility, whatever rank you've got. With all due respect, Lord Oxley, says Grant, who has clearly and surprisingly done his homework, although Thomas rather suspects Beverly Brooke's hand in it. This is entirely to do with the Metropolitan Police Service, and as Inspector Nightingale's superior officer, it's very much my responsibility. Oxley laughs. Tyburn shoots him an irritated look. I'm no Lord, Commander Grant. Very well, then, say your piece, Tyburn says testily. Her mother looks at her quellingly. Tyburn ducks her head. I think the first order of business is an apology, says Grant. That sets the cat amongst the pigeons in a way Thomas could only hope to. Whispers run up and down the room. Mother Thames actually deigns to raise an eyebrow. Fleet looks very thoughtful. Thomas, in contrast, feels his spine stiffen. Things obviously haven't been handled the way they should have been, Grant goes on. I don't just mean on Inspector Nightingale's part. I mean by our organisation as a whole. It's our responsibility to ensure that all of our people have the support they need to carry out the full extent of their jobs, and Inspector Nightingale, regrettably, has not. I hope you understand that his taking on apprentices represents our first steps to remedy that. As if what we want is more wizards, says Ephra distastefully. I know your community is a lot more than that. If you know of anybody... Grant gropes for a word. Relevant, who's already working for the Met, then let us know who they are. I'm sure Inspector Nightingale will be happy to work with them. In the meantime, he's not accused of anything. He's not guilty of anything that would mean his removal from his position. So unless there's a general feeling, which doesn't mean one or two of you, it means among the whole community, that you can't work with him any longer, he stays. Mistakes, says Tyburn, were made. Is that it? No, Grant says. I read the report on Berwick Street. I talked to him about it. He fucked up. Sometimes we do that. This is why we have specialist staff for hostage negotiations. The trouble was that the only person who was capable of subduing the suspect was him. And if he failed, then there wasn't anybody else who could. It's not a situation that lends itself to de-escalation. That doesn't fix anything, says Tyburn. It doesn't make him any more likely not to fuck up again, as you put it. When I first learned about the less conventionally explicable aspects of the Met's role, as represented by the folly, says Grant, addressing Mother Thames and the rest of the rivers as much as Tyburn, I heard the word agreement a lot. And that makes sense to me, because that's what this is, you know. We have to have agreement that we have our jobs and what those jobs are. When that breaks down on either side, you get, well, people start dying, mostly. What we have, the rest of the Met, I mean, that you don't, is formal ways for people to tell us when they feel like the agreements aren't being kept. Not by bailing up individual officers. You're going to suggest an advisory group, says Tyburn. She sounds like this isn't an entirely ridiculous concept. Thomas does know about the Met's independent advisory groups, but the concept of having one for the Gina Lacorum, or any other practitioners for that matter, is more logical than it sounds at first blush. It's worked, says Grant. Not perfectly, but it's worked. Why not for you? Although, a problem we tend to have with them, generally speaking, is that the people who make the most noise aren't actually the ones with the biggest problems, by and large. People who feel comfortable talking to us are already comfortable with us. I think the question also is, how do we find the people who don't want to do that? You're all goddesses. He pauses and nods to Oxley, and a god, of course. It's the people like Jacob Miller we need to be the most worried about. There are people who don't want to be noticed or found, Tyburn shoots back. I know you know that. Those quiet people under their hill. If people have reason to fear the consequences of being noticed, which frankly it sounds like they did for a very long time, then of course. But we fix that by making it safe for them, not by pretending they don't exist. The folly isn't part of our world, says Tyburn. It stands against us. Thomas takes a breath to speak, because that's unfair and untrue, but Grant's ahead of him, of course. I don't care if that's true, or if it ever was. It can't be true any longer. The police are the public, and the public are the police. You want in, Cecilia. I know you do, because we've talked about it. You can have in. Special constabulary, whatever. Something can be worked out. But that means working by the same rules we have to. Up to you. All of you. Any takers? There's a very special sort of stunned silence that is only ruined by Abigail making a faint squeaking noise like she can't keep her surprise in. At least Thomas thinks it's Abigail. It could be a river, he supposes. You have a lot of things to say, Commander Grant, says Mother Thames at length, and a silver tongue to say them with. Well, I get a lot of practice, says Grant. Comes with the job. I want your oath on it, she says. You say you stand behind him, that he's part of something you represent. You stand and fall with him, then. On my mother's life, Grant says. Not even a moment of hesitation. God damn him. As a commander of the Metropolitan Police Service. He's ours. Our problem. Our representative. Whatever else he is, too. He does the same job we all do, for the people of this city, because we are the people of this city. Very well, says Mother Thames, and Thomas can feel the power of it. Another agreement made, like the tide and the rain and the wind off the sea, but like something else too. The smell of a fog and the faint shrill of a silver whistle. Oh, this is something, but he doesn't know yet what. Tyburn, whatever it is you are doing, whoever it is you're sending after the Nightingale, let it go. That's not our agreement. Oxley, I can consult my father, but I've no doubt that will satisfy him, Oxley says. He never liked this to start with. He's no particular care for bureaucracy, nor love of the police, to tell the truth, but he understands standing with your own. Mum, says Tyburn almost desperately. No, you can't let him. Tyburn, her mother snaps, and she stiffens, closes her mouth. You may go, Mother Thames says to Grant and to Thomas. but best if we don't need to have this meeting again, hmm? Thank you, ma'am, says Grant. It's been a pleasure. Cecilia, he nods to Tyburn. She stares back, her eyes as black as coal. Grant's burnt that bridge for certain. Thomas wonders if it'd be worth it to him. They turn to leave. Abigail, still a bit wild-eyed, falling smoothly enough in behind. The rivers watch them go. It's always difficult to walk away from something like this, the urge to speed up feeling nearly inexorable. But Grant keeps a measured pace a step behind him, and it helps. When he gets outside, however, his dignified escape is ground to a halt by a deeply petty but very real problem. While he was inside, the jag has been blocked in, and not by the slightly beaten up electric Ford the apprentices share. That's a little off to the right. Presumably Abigail transported herself and Grant there in it. Didn't really get a chance to warn you about that, says Grant. Sorry. Thomas sighs. It really has been that kind of day. I know, says Beverly Brooke behind him. It feels like she's always behind him. It's starting to make him twitch. Ty's little power play, sorry. Give me 5 minutes and I'll get them moved. Why? He has to ask. She shrugs one shoulder. I didn't go to all the trouble of getting Peter in for nothing. He frowns at her, and she just looks back, unmoved. He wishes he knew what she wanted. I think he's right, for what it's worth, she says, nodding at Grant. Thomas wonders how much time they've been spending together, that she calls him Peter. Or maybe it's just that they're young. Thanks for the support, Grant says dryly. Don't be like that about it, she rolls her eyes. You have a point, you made it stick with Mum. Ty's also going to hold it against you forever and a day, but I think you knew that. Grant grimaces. Well, yeah. Had to be done. Don't worry yourself about the cars, Thomas says. I'll see to it. It's partly because of what's just happened, and partly because he's genuinely irritated, and partly because he can, and maybe somewhere deep down showing off a little for Grant. But it isn't very hard, really, all things considered, to, with a few whispered words and a raised hand, knock over a handbrake or two, give a gentle push to get the cars going, and slide them carefully out of the way. Then re-engage the brakes, of course. Nobody's going to be happy if their car ends up in their mother's river, and he's not out to make enemies. More impressive to lift them up, of course, but that much more magic would certainly blow out the electrics, and that would be just as bad as the river, maybe worse. It would seem more pointed. Beverly Brooke just shakes her head after glowering at her own bright yellow Mini safely three cars away and walks back inside. Of course, she was never going to be impressed. Abigail has her arms folded and is clearly trying to look as if she doesn't think it's anything much, but the way she's squinting says she wants to know how to do it. Nice, sir, she says grudgingly. Grant is grinning broadly, like he's seen something beautiful or unexpected, and, well, that was the reaction Thomas was hoping for, even if he's still not sure how he feels about Grant coming here like this. Well, he is sure. He's not happy. There's something else surging that isn't quite unhappiness, but something else. He daren't call it anger. May I offer you a lift, Commander? He says. I'm getting the impression, Grant says, the smile fading from his face, you're not happy with what just happened. You shouldn't have done that, Thomas says, before he can think better of it, of Abigail watching, of who might be listening, of the fact that they just need to leave. Oh, says Grant, really? Thomas steps closer to him, keeping his voice controlled. I know you meant well, but it wasn't safe. You didn't even know magic existed a year ago. You don't understand the power in that room. What could have happened to you? He just wants to make Grant understand. This is his job. This is his responsibility. If he lets something happen to a senior Met officer, everything really would start to unravel. Petty things like suspensions can be worked around or under, but this is where the real powers come out to play. Fuck that, Grant almost sounds like he can hear what Thomas is thinking. This is my job. You are losing their respect. You know that. I know that. The entire point of what I do is managing how people think about us, about the police, and it's not your place to tell me no or how to do it. Thomas can see, out of the corner of his eye, Abigail open her mouth, then close it and step back like the cars might hide her. They can't do this here, but it's happening anyway. This is my job, he says to Grant. If we're going to talk about respect, you have to respect that. Okay, Inspector, we're done. Grant interrupts him, speaking over the last few words. His eyes are very hard. Go home. Try not to screw this up again, because Tyburn's going to be looking for you to give her a chance. Thomas opens his mouth to say, wait, no, I didn't mean it like that. I know what you were trying to do for me. I don't... But Grant is already turning to Abigail. Thank you for the lift, Constable. I'll find my own way back. Wait, Abigail says quickly. I can drive you. I brought you here. I'll walk, Grant snaps, his mouth thin with anger. And he does exactly that, away and around the corner and out of sight. He fucked up. Grant's voice echoes in Thomas's head. And hasn't he just... Thomas drives very carefully on the way home. He's in the sort of mood that leads to carelessness. He gets back to the Folly before Abigail and debates the merits of waiting for her in the garage. It wins out because he doesn't want to have this discussion in front of the others. It's not good practice. Sir, Abigail says when she gets out of the car and sees him waiting next to the Jag. You're better than the GPS. I got stuck in traffic going through the city. How did you end up bringing Commander Grant to Mama Tem's court, Abigail? She straightens, almost mutinously, all 5'5" of her. He came by and said he needed to go give you a hand. Could he trouble me for a lift? Of course, Thomas couldn't expect her to say no to that sort of request from somebody of Grant's rank. That's not even a question. I don't expect you to say no to a senior officer under those circumstances, he says. But that isn't the only way to handle that sort of situation. There will be times, there are always times, with our particular job, where somebody doesn't understand the situation, or thinks they know more than they do. Even being a chief inspector, he gestures at himself, isn't always sufficient to the problem. You have to learn to work around it. No, sir, that's not... I would have said no if I thought it was the wrong thing to do, says Abigail. I did ask him why first. Oh, really? Abigail shrugs. Look, we're his pet project. He wouldn't have been there today if that wasn't true. If I can't get away with asking him stuff in an emergency because of that, then when? Really? Thomas says again. To be clear on this point, you knew what he intended to do and you brought him anyway. As opposed to letting him get the address from Beverly Brook or whatever and just getting a taxi, says Abigail somewhat incredulously. Well, yeah. He could have been in some danger. Which is why it seemed like a really bad idea to let him go alone. Thomas is forced to cede that point. Nevertheless, you're going to have to learn better stalling tactics. I wouldn't have stalled him even if I'd known you wanted me to, Abigail says, like a thrown gauntlet. He was right, and had the right to tell me what to do. Sorry, sir. Oh, no, Thomas says. You don't get to cite his rank and then say you obeyed him because you agree with him. One or other, Constable. He could swear she grows a couple of inches, standing her ground. Wild horses can't move her, Grant had said months ago. Do you really think it would have gone better if he hadn't shown up? Because I don't think so. No, Thomas says simply. It takes her aback. That's not the point of this discussion. Sir? The point, he continues, is that if this is going to work, Abigail, you have to trust me, and you have to listen to instructions. They might not always make sense in the moment. They might not always make sense after. But I can't always stop to explain or wait for you to decide if you agree. My job is to train you and keep you safe as much as that is possible, as much as I am capable. I need to know you believe that or... Of course I do. Her voice rises and wavers. I know that, sir, of course I... He said he could help you. I brought him because I thought he could help you. I'm not going to... I know about orders, sir. She flexes her fingers like she doesn't know what to do with her hands. Somebody has to look after you too. That's not how it works, Thomas wants to say, but maybe it is. Next time, he says, you could try and send a message ahead. There's a remarkable range of options for that nowadays. Sir, says Abigail, I... Yes, sir. Can I... Do you need me to... I'm sure you've got things to be getting on with. Thomas says, and she nods emphatically and turns to go. She pauses in the doorway, though. Also, she adds, sir, check your phone. Thomas hadn't even thought of it through this whole thing. There are a slew of messages. The top one is from Abigail. On the way with Commander Grant, it says. He asked for a lift. He puts a hand on his face, squeezes his eyes shut, tries to take a step back. Today is just not going well at all.